So this next presentation, or our first presentation of the day, is going to be remote. The progress of ATSC 3 rollout from the broadcaster and consumer electronics perspective. It'll be delivered by Dave Folsom, who is part of the Pearl organization, and they have a test facility out in Phoenix. It's a consortium of broadcasters, consumer electronics folks, and this is where they test a lot of the encoding and reception and see if everything works as expected. So Dave will be available for questions, live questions, after the presentation. So we'll get it going. Roll tape.
Thank you for inviting me to the WBA Broadcasters Clinic Conference. Today, I hope to spend a little time talking about the progress of the ATSC 3 rollout. We properly call it next-gen television, but we hope to tell you how it's going, not only from a broadcaster's perspective, but also from the consumer electronics perspective. First, a little about Pearl TV. I work for Pearl TV, and Pearl TV, if you don't know, most people in broadcasting have heard of Pearl, but may not know exactly how it came about. It's a organization that doesn't create a product. It represents the U.S. broadcasters who are members. There's nine individual companies. They're big broadcast companies like Hearst and Scripps and so forth. They represent about 750 total TV stations in the country, and we look at technological solutions that will help push the business forward, and that's really our role. In addition, we manage the Pearl Network Consortia, or PNC, which is made up of the four major networks that we all know and love, and they, including, by the way, Univision as well, for a total of 5 or 14 organizations altogether. And again, they're primarily focused on the ATSC 3 and 3 standard. But in it is true, though, that most of what we're doing right at the moment is ATSC 3, although we've worked on other projects in the past. I'm going to use this as a kind of a blatant and a shameless plug for a manual that I've written. It's now in its 11th version. The good news is it's free. You can download it at www.pearltv.com under resources. And it probably has an awful lot of technical information in there, written in a popular style, easy to understand, tells you how to get a host station up, and goes in much better depth about a lot of the technical information I'll talk about today when we don't have as much time. What we'll discuss today will be the quick overview of the standard, status of market transitions, status of transmission equipment and how it's coming along, status of consumer receivers and how they're selling, requirements for next-gen TV security, single frequency network testing that we've done this year, the Run3 TV application framework, which we'll go into a little bit and give you a feeling for what that does for next-gen TV. And also something relatively new that you may not have heard of, which is the broadband delivery of next-gen TV. Okay, quick overview of the standard. I'm not going to go into very much detail because we don't have a lot of time, but there are six really noteworthy features that I always focus in on, which is that next-gen really is evolvable. Unlike ATSC 1 that we're using now for on-air television, we're fixed in its capabilities. Not that they're bad at all, and 20 years ago when it was developed, it was a good standard. But now we have a standard with ATSC 3 that is much more evolvable. As new technologies are created, they'll be able to be included, and that's a big deal. It has over-the-air and over-the-top a delivery capability, enhanced picture quality, we all know about that, 4K, HDR, wide color gamut, immersive audio, with Voice Plus or voice-centric listening, a controllable dynamic range as well. It also includes W3C HTML5-based broadcaster application capability, and we'll get into a little of that as well. And content security and service protection are a big part of the new next-gen TV. Next-gen TV, they're under the hood. It's really, we talk about it as a standard, ATSC3 standard, but it's really 22 individual standards, including 10 recommended practices, as well as two group technical reports. So it's well over 1,000 pages of technology that you really have to read through. I've kind of lived it for the past 5 years, and I think I know just a little, enough to write a manual, but it was still learning more about the standard. It is quite involved, quite capable, and should last us a number of years. It's based in Internet Protocol. Uses UDP and multicast addressing in IP. And for those who are familiar with IP, uses CFDM modulation and LDCP coding, which is, I think, a far cry from the coding that is used currently in ATSC1, which is not as sophisticated. And that makes a big difference, which we'll see in a couple of minutes. It has requirements for content content and service security, built-in interactive capabilities, and advanced and more efficient video and audio capabilities. One of the big mistakes that people are misunderstanding that they have about understanding how television transmission works is the whole question of noise threshold. And this is a big part of what ATSC3 is. When people are talking about ATSC3, they're always talking about it has a better noise threshold. And the numbers are confusing, and we won't get in too much depth about it, but it sounds like the threshold number that you hear, it seems like it's going in the wrong direction. In other words, when somebody says it's got a 25 dB noise threshold, it sounds like that's a good thing. And a 10 dB noise threshold sounds like a bad thing. It's actually the other way around. If the receiver is capable of receiving down to as poor a signal of noise as 10 dB, as shown in the graph here, then your coverage will be much greater than a signal of noise a threshold of 25 dB. So you have to be careful when people say this has a better noise threshold or it's got a poorer noise threshold. It sounds like the numbers are going in the wrong direction. But just remember that if the numbers go down, the coverage will be greater. And as we'll see later, probably the capacity of the channel will be less. But it's still, coverage is an inverse, think of it that way, of this signal to noise threshold. This is where we can put that signal to noise threshold into action. And I'm sorry, I have to show you a curve, and we'll try to keep the technology to a minimum here. But this is known as the Shannon limit capacity curve, or and it's based on mathematical work done by Claude Shannon back in the late 1940s. He worked for AT&T and MIT and a number of other locations. And he figured mathematically what the limit would be for the amount of data that could be passed through a channel of a given bandwidth. So if you plot a given bandwidth and you know the amount of modulation and coding they're using, you can plot how much bandwidth you'll get and what the noise threshold will be for the receiver at that particular, the signal of noise that you receive at a given point in the curve. So how does that translate into what you want? Well, let's say that the maximum that you can receive or want to receive is at a threshold of, let's say, 15 dB, which happens to be the FCC's model receiver for ATSC1. And you'll notice that directly above the 15 dB portion on this curve, you see where ATSC1 shows up, and it's well below the Shannon curve, meaning that the capacity that it provides is only about 19.4 megabits per second in the channel at 15 dB, which is really not a lot of capacity compared to what you could do at the same signal to noise or the same threshold in ATSC 3. If you go further up and look above where ATSC 1 A53 standard lies on this curve, you'll notice there's little X's and different colors. And those indicate different modulation encoding points that are capable. It isn't set like ATSC 1 to a single modulation encoding. You can control five or six different code levels from QPSK all the way up to 4096, and you can control the amount of forward error correction you have, or coding as it's known. So you can ride up and down that curve and trade the amount of coverage you have for the amount of data bandwidth that you want. So if you want to transmit a lot of data bandwidth, let's say well above 20 megabits per second, you can trade your coverage a little bit for more bandwidth. Or you can go the other way down the curve and maybe accept 15 megabits a second worth of data bandwidth, but increase your coverage maybe 20 or 30% above what you have now with ATSC 1. It's an interesting thing. This is really at the very base of why ATSC 3 or NextGen TV is so much better. Okay, what does ATSC 3 have with a Matryoshka doll? And many of you may know that Eastern Europe, the Matryoshka doll is a very common toy where one doll fits inside the other. Seven are shown here, and there's a reason for that, because it shares a common capability with ATSC 3. I like to think about it this way because it takes something complex and makes it a little easier to understand. It's based in the AOSI 7-layer model and Open Systems 7-layer capability, from the physical layer, which is the RF that all of us always think about in transmission, all the way up to the application layer, which would have the actual presentation and the playback of whatever the content is. And in between, there the individual layers, which we'll see in a minute, all can stand on their own. And they all have headers. It's shown on the left in the middle there. It says PH for presentation header, or SH for session header. And each one of those data chunks sit inside the chunk afterwards and on down to the physical layer. That allows us to make changes in one layer without impacting the other. And that is at the very bottom of the extensibility of the NextGen TV. So it's important to be able to have that capability of changing something in the standard without breaking TV sets or making it unusable going forward. So it's right at the base of the evolvability of NextGen TV. Here's the NextGen TV stack, and it's you can see down the left hand side of this graphic. Where the application layer starts at the top, and at the very bottom is the physical layer. And those are the things that are contained in each one of the layers. There's no test, so you don't have to remember all of this. I just want to tell you to show to you that it really is based in the OSI 7-layer model. And if you look, the broadcast stack is on the left, and on the right, the broadband stack exists. And the physical layer is quite different, and it also we use TCP IP instead of UDP. And we'll get on to that in a little bit. The basic transmission equipment is made up of encoders, and you can have multiple encoders at one time, like you can in ATSC 1, a dash packager, which breaks it into chunks so later it can be multiplexed much more easily, kind of like the internet does with HLS and dash. Then there's a route encapsulator, which encapsulates and multiplexes all of the various streams, both video, audio, closed captioning, non-real-time data. Also puts a signaling in, which is metadata, that tells the receiver how to receive all of this, how to unwrap those seven layers. And then it goes through a broadcast gateway scheduler, where it's wrapped again in what's called the link layer, where it is prepared to send out on the physical transport, which is the exciter and transmitter shown at the bottom. So those are shown as individual boxes, Likely they're not individual boxes because it's just software. They're running on servers. So if you went into a next-gen TV facility and you would look for special equipment for next-gen, you wouldn't find it. It's just some Dell servers or some HP servers and running software. And what is playing on which server is really up to the broadcaster and the manufacturers. Okay, the status of the transition. Right now, we have 51 markets on the air, hopefully by the end of this year. They're, you know, with COVID and other things, it may be a little less than that, but it'll be probably some number between 40 and 50. And each one of the markets has at least one host station with usually five individual services on it. So we could have well over 250 stations on the air by the end of the year, and reaching about 59% of the U.S. households. There are some markets, there's 13 here shown, that actually have two hosts on the air. So that's why the number is really larger than 250 or 51 times five stations. So it's that's a good showing for the fact that conversions have only been taking place since the middle of last year. So I think it's been moving along really well. Difficult markets will continue. We have some markets where there just isn't enough free bandwidth available because we have to move around ATSC 1 services and share them with other competitive services to free up an empty channel so that we can. The FCC did not give us more bandwidth. So there are some big markets that are going to be a little problematic, but we'll speak of some of the solutions in a moment. But we're making some progress in many of those markets. And the number after each one of those markets is its market size. Next-gen TV launch projections, you can see it's going to be in this 60% range, as I showed you in the earlier, by the end of this year. And we're hoping by the mid 2022, we'll be in the 76% of the US households, and to 80% with any luck at all by the end of 22. So far, so good. We've met most of our goals, and the predictions are getting better. Things are actually moving faster. COVID started a little slow, but by mid-year this year, we got going pretty well, as you can see in the curve. Okay, the status of the television equipment. Again, we talked about the fact that most of this is software. This is a nice way of looking at what the transmission chain looks like, but the reality of the matter is they're individual modules, usually running in virtual machines on individual servers. There's lots of companies that are involved in writing that software or making specialized equipment to work with it, like test equipment, for example. Sencor, for example, just released on this chart, just released a couple of new receivers last week. CleverLogic is a Korean company building a laboratory type receiver. Google is on there because Google Widevine is used for their security system. We'll talk about that in a bit. Status of the consumer receivers. There's lots of receivers out there, and what's really enabled those receivers are what you're looking at. There are two chips here that are, these happen to be Sony's, LG, MediaTek. There's a number of companies making chips. I just wanted to show you how tiny they were. The chip on the left in the middle of the picture here is very tiny compared to a penny, as you can see. And it's a dual ATSC1, ATSC3 tuner. And that's important to remember. And it'll become important here in a minute. To the middle is a demodulator chip that takes the output of the tuner and turns it into IP data. It doesn't decode the video and audio yet. That's done elsewhere, which I'll show you in a moment. But that gives you a feeling for how tiny these chips really are. There's another one. This one happens to be the LG tuner chip. Again, has ATSC1 and ATSC3 in the same chip. Okay, this is an actual receiver. Hard to see from scale. This is shown, depending on the size of the TV set. It's about the size of two playing cards side by side, maybe a little smaller than that. You can see the HDMI connectors on there that kind of give you some, or the F connector at the bottom kind of gives you some feeling for size. The actual ATSC3 chips are so small, it's hard to point them out, but they're down in the area of the where the antenna connector is at the bottom, kind of under the label. That large heatsink in the middle is for an SoC. And a system on a chip, think of it as a specialized computer. It's doing all the video and audio decoding. It's doing really the display when you have a smart TV set, all of the display you looked at, it has the memory, addresses the memory. It's essentially a computer. That's why it has a big heatsink on it. It's doing really all the work in the receiver beyond receiving the signal off the air. The balance of those other little chips you see there are all for driving the HDMI connectors and the Wi-Fi pickup and that kind of thing. The reason I really want to show you this is it's important to understand that it is easier for the receiver manufacturers to build a single receiver. Although the display changes in size, the electronics in nearly all receivers by a certain manufacturer are generally the same. So taking that forward, it costs them more money to build a receiver that is ATSC3 capable and one that isn't. It's easier, as you saw earlier, I showed you the chips had the ATSC1 and ATSC3 chip in it, the capability within the single chip. So it's just easier for them to build the receiver with ATSC3 capability built into it and going forward. So last year we saw only about 20 receivers. This year there's over 70. And by next year, there'll probably be 150 or 200 individual models that will have it. And the reason is not only are they in favor of ATSC3, but also that it's just easier, simpler, and less expensive for them to build one type of TV set than it is to try to support two different modules. Okay, without spending a lot of time on here, these are the sets that are available. There's over 70 of them. These are the Sonys. You can see about 3/4 of the way down on the right-hand part of the chart, one is as little as $599, and that's at list price. That isn't the Costco price or the, you know, the discount price that you probably really will pay, but that's, so it's very affordable. And the impact on cost by adding ATSC3 is so negligible that it probably is lost. It isn't like the days of conversion ATSC1, where the cost of the receivers was incredibly high. Again, here are Sony and LG and Samsung receivers. Again, adding them all up with different sizes and different types, different model types, well over 70. And the price ranges, you can notice there's an LG there for $20,000, but it's an 88-inch, and it's their special super-duper micro dot system. So it you can spend a lot of money for one of these, but you know, $599 is where it begins. They'll also, in hopefully in 2022, have other auxiliary type devices that we'll be able to provide that will have, when I say we, I'm talking about the industry, to provide to viewers. There'll be little fobs or little boxes that they'll be able to plug into their current TV sets and be able to receive ATSC3. It got off to a little bit of a slow start, mainly because of the worldwide chip shortage, which I think you probably have all heard about and read about. You know, there is a silicon dust, a home HD home run, but there's about all those sold so far. But we see that at a lower, much lower price point of $60 to $150 for other auxiliary devices, if you will. Connected TVs and household penetration. This is kind of a redo of the two of the earlier charts I saw that you saw. The sales will be over 3 million next-gen TVs by the end of this year. And we see a significant growth for next year in sales and also penetration, which is the other curve on the screen of next-gen transmissions. To the individual markets. So in over 100 million households, hopefully by 2027. As you may know, there's almost 130 million households in the U.S. right now. So that by 2027, that's not too far away to get that kind of penetration and to get that many receivers out there. Okay, next-gen security. We won't go too much into detail here, but it really is two levels of security. There's content security and service protection. Content security will be required by the networks to protect their content because it's IP-based. You know, that concern of piracy is a concern that people will be recording, an IP stream, and then it'll show up on the internet the next day, and that's just not good. So part of the ecosystem for next-gen television includes content security. It's invisible to the user or to the viewer, very much the way a DVD is now. It's been encrypted for years, and when you play a DVD, the fact that there's it's encrypted and there's a license and key on the player, you may or may not know about that, but it's invisible to the user of the DVD. Same with next-gen. There's the security authority that's run by the networks. They will provide the authority to Widevine, which is a division of Google, who will provide the keys. It'll be scrambled or encrypted at your TV station, transmitted, and the receiver has shown in the lower right-hand corner here, has the licenses and the keys needed to decrypt it. That simple. In addition, there's service protection. Service protection, think of it as like if you get on a website now and you'll notice it says HTTPS, that shows it's a secure website. It just tells you as a user of the web that you are actually at the website you think you're at, because they have a certificate authority and a certificate exchange back and forth with your browser that proves that they are who they say they are. There'll be a similar kind of transaction taking place with your transmission and the TV set. And the TV set will warn the viewer or blank the screen if it sees that there's been a man-in-the-middle attack or the certificate is not correct. It's left to the receiver manufacturer what actually happens. So that, again, is to prevent a man-in-the-middle attack. It has happened. It's happened in radio, and it's particularly when you're dealing in the IP realm, it's really easy to do. So, okay, single frequency network testing. We in Phoenix, the Phoenix Model Market Partnership that's managed by Pearl, created the an SFN. And the SFN is made up of two nodes. We'll eventually hopefully go to four nodes, and that's what you see on the screen here. But the two nodes that were done for the testing is the green outer circle. You'll see there's a circle that's the original transmission for the station that was tested. In addition, there's a blue circle, and that blue circle is the second node, which you'll notice is occupies inside of the coverage area for the full station. So it's on the same frequency, and normally they would interfere with each other, which they do, but then we adjust the timing very carefully so that their interference actually helps the signal reception rather than hurting it. And that's the magic of a COFDM and the magic of single frequency networks. And eventually we hope to have maybe two more transmissions going on, and we'll be able to do even more testing. But the initial testing, the results were really very, very good. The short version here, because I want to be cognizant of time, is we increased the service margin for 40 of the test sites by about 6 dB, which is a huge. And that's at both 30 feet and 10 dB at 12 feet receive height, which is really, I think, more realistic height than the FCC mandated 30 feet. Service availability was also improved in the 40 sites that were tested, and we had absolute error-free reception in 80% of the 32 of 40 total test sites, and which is interesting because we were on the backside of a mountain where some of those test sites were, and completely blanked. The people on the backside did not have reception from the primary node at all, so that the only source of their transmission was the second node of the SFN, which, again, these were so much better than we had hoped in terms of capability. So we have a lot of hope for SFNs going forward. You can read the complete results of the field trial. It's a 40-page document and lots of detail. It's available at, like my manual, at www.pearltv.com. Under resources, you can download the complete report. Okay, the application, I think I mentioned that the application in or interactive capability, including an application, is available in NextGen TV. If you don't know it when you're watching a NextGen TV, you're looking at a browser. You're looking, the TV set is a huge web browser. Think of it that way. It's the easiest way to understand what how it works. So if you're looking at that base layer, which is shown on the left-hand lower side here, you have a layer that's in between that you can put things on top of the layer underneath, and that's in your control. And if you want to surround what the lower layer is with content, you can do that as well, because one of the things you can do is control a consumer's receiver to squeeze the picture down or to move it over. So things like squeeze backs, which you now have to do inside your studio, you actually can control inside the receiver. And we'll show some more magic with that in a moment. The application framework that Pearl has created sits between this browser that the receivers provide and our capability provided by the standard and the programming that you'll create, the application you'll create to give you, and this application framework provides a lot more capability than is built basically into the receiver. It also makes all receivers from the application point of view act the same. And that's a big deal because you want to be able to predict what's happening in the home receiver. So that application has been created on behalf of broadcasting, and we hope you will use it. And we intend to get more information out to everybody as they run out to start up their next-gen TV stations and talk about how we're going to do it. This is what it looks like. This is an emulation of obviously the NBC Nightly News. And if you right-click on your remote control of your TV set, it pulls out the first menu, which is way over on the left, and you can then navigate down to Guide or the to Explore or the NBC app, if NBC provides an app, or maybe the Weather. And when you select one of those, then another menu comes out. You can see it's shown in where the Nightly News because it's on there. Law and Order coming up, whatever it is, and it's up to you. We're not determining what it says in there. That's totally up to the broadcaster. Another version of it is a little more has a little more content in it, including, by the way, as it's shown, you can push over the top content so that if somebody selects community here or maybe sports highlights, and they'll see these clips, they can navigate over and click on it and the clip will start playing and it'll cover over the top of what you're watching. Or it may be information about program that you're watching if you want to know who the star's name is or whatever. I mean, you do this now with over-the-top capability with Netflix and others. This gives broadcasters that same kind of capability. It also has the ability to do other things. I mean, you could drop the lower thirds, you can drop advertisements. I mean, it's really up to your, it may be promotional information down at the bottom. These are all video that's on the air, but the tag at the bottom, you're seeing at the bottom, is placed on by the application. And the one on the left, you'll notice the video has been squeezed back, or it can be laid over. In the case of the one in the upper right-hand corner, the video was laid over it. It's really kind of up to the way you program the capability. Okay, broadband delivery. You remember the stack I showed you, the right-hand side was showed broadband capability in next-gen TV. Well, how will you use that? We saw the original chain that's used in next-gen TV, but it's only over the air. So if we add a little bit of capability beyond that, we get this. And really what you're seeing here at the middle line going through is the same thing that you saw in the earlier image. And above that is the over-the-air transmitter and the exciter, just as we saw in the earlier one. So below that, in a red dotted line, you'll notice that there's some additional equipment, a couple of pieces of equipment shown in orange. And that is a broadband guide builder, and in addition, origin server, which provides the other content that you want to push out to the internet. So what happens is you signal over the air that you have other services. The receiver gets that signal and it's told where on the internet to find it. And that reaches out to the address that is provided by that origin server. And it's pushed out through a CDN and a managed cloud to the people, to the viewer's home receiver. So that gives you the ability to have your normal over-the-air services that you have, but in addition, seamlessly to the viewers, you can add other services if you don't have enough bandwidth. You can use the broadband delivery. Now, we'll be talking more about how that's done in other sessions and in publicity that we'll be sending out, but this is a great capability for next-gen TV. Because we're bandwidth bound right at the moment, because we're trying to do this transition while still staying on ATSC-1, having this capability provides a means for us to be able to get multicast on in ATSC-3. But it also provides capabilities for doing other things that we think would be in the best interest of the viewers, other content, or maybe we show a 4K version of the Olympics on pushing it over the top, and the 2K version will come over the air. So that's about it. I'm going to open it up for questions.
Hello, Dave. Kent Ashenbrunner, can you hear me?
Yes, I can.
Hey, thank you very much for this fine presentation, and we want to congratulate you for your receiving the NAB Engineering Achievement Award for television. So I know the great work that you do with Pearl, and been at it a long time, so thank you. Bill Hubbard will moderate the questions. So
thank you.
Take it away.
Good morning, Dave. Thanks again for being here, and we open up the floor for a live question and answer and a little echo. Is the coffee settling in out there? Everybody waking up? Good deal on the coffee. I got a thumbs up. Any questions for our presenter? Yes, we have one right there.
Hi, Dave. My name is Vicki Kipp, and I was wondering, if you place all of your content in one PLP, does that prevent you from being able to use layered division multiplexing?
No and yes. here's the issue. If you're using layered division multiplexing, which is a means by which you can send two signals on top of each other in the physical layer, and gain some noise immunity, and you also gain a little bit of efficiency. It's one of the tricks you can do. I didn't get into it because of time, but that really requires the two layers to be in different PLPs. And so even if you have a primary or base layer of in one PLP, second layer, enhancement layer, would have to be in a second PLP. It's required. So it's just a requirement of the signaling, and it also helps the receiver understand what's going on. It's really one service, but carried in two PLPs.
Okay, and over here.
Good morning, Anton Capella, Edge Micro. I had sent these questions via text, so please disregard them. We don't need a redundant ask. And I'll ignore the first one, which was about a penetration question. You had shown a slide about some of the estimated curves of the uptake rates. So thanks for that information. The remaining question has to deal with potential authentication questions and But the larger question of, you know, let's say a pirate source exists somewhere in a market, TVs can tune to it, and now it looks like they can run things that resemble JavaScript, maybe exactly is JavaScript in another form. And if they have a connection to the internet, now I'm really curious what we can do or what we have available to us to ensure that such a pirate source is maybe minimized or unavailable to the receivers. So the redux here could be, is there any way to ensure that a surreptitious miscreant source does not influence such a receiver in any negative way? For example, causing it to fetch given URLs, grab web content from who knows where. This could all be inside SSL. These could all be wrapped in certs. So as far as the system is concerned, it's air quotes correct and valid content, but it's surreptitious. It's unwanted content, unwanted activity. So are there mechanisms, you know, for us as operators in the case of a miscreant or pirate source to minimize or eliminate that from a given market area or given activity area?
Yeah, there's a couple of layers ways in which the broadcaster and the viewer, who you have to care about the most is the viewer, is protected. Whether you take the signal in or the service in from the internet and broadband, or you take it over the air, it has to be authenticated or signed in ATSC3's parlance. And that's service protection. And that service protection says that it's from a valid source. But also, in the case of a application, the application has to be signed as well. And it must be signed differently by the author and authenticated. And it has to be signed also by the broadcaster. So the service, the primary service, which would be video and audio, would be signed, and the signaling for it. But also at the same time, the application itself is signed and has a certification, and the original author has a certification. So that provides, even in the most wild case, a set of forensics so you can figure out what happened should something get through, but it unlikely will, because the receiver's behavior, which we don't control, should tell the viewer that the sources are not trusted. And they're in a similar way to SSL, but also if the application is delivered via the internet, then the standard SSL type, SSL is going out of fashion now, there's a newer standard for that, but the point being is that secure layer web services would then protect the viewer and the broadcaster. So. Is it? I'll never say it's impossible for somebody to get around that, but it's difficult. And I should also mention that the signing of the signaling of the certification, if you will, is carried in encrypted form with a key that's unique to the broadcaster. It uses standard cryptology that would be pretty impossible to crack. And nothing's ever impossible, but it would be more trouble than it would be worth. Did I answer your question, I hope? And by the way, it's required
yes,
by the standard, it's not optional.
We're getting a thumbs up on that, Dave. Thank you.
I forgot to mention that signing and the signaling is not optional. It's required by the standard.
Dave, I believe Pearl a while back got together some end users to kind of give you feedback on what was the good and maybe not so good stuff about this ATSC and what it has to offer. If that's true, can you give us some highlights on what the takeaways were from the people who got to see this for the first time?
Yeah. What I won't say surprised us, but what was interesting was that we thought that, well, everybody would be really excited about the fact that it's 4K or that it's high dynamic range and other things, which people were interested in and broadcasters were interested in. But believe it or not, one of the highest things that came about in the surveys, and we did this using Nielsen, and we went out to, in Magid as well, went out to test audiences, showing them a test content. And they really loved the enhanced audio, particularly the what's now called Voice Plus, which raises the dialogue and you can control the amount of raise in dialogue. They like the evolvability of the standard, meaning, you know, for example, and I think Ann Shelley, who runs Pearl, uses this example of, it's hard to buy a phone now that doesn't have 5G capability, new phones. And, you know, 5G hasn't rolled out completely by any means. And yet people want to have a 5G phone because they want to have a device that is not going to become irrelevant or not useful in the future. So the same way, I think, with AT&T 3, the viewers said, geez, we love the evolvability and the fact that we're buying something that's not only works with current standards, but will work with future standards. So they're buying a future purchase, I guess, is the best way of putting it. And that meant a lot to them. So again, those tested highest. HDR, I think, tested a little higher than 4K. Because, of course, I think you've probably seen that the greatest improvement in the video signal comes as a result of use of high dynamic range with high dynamic range source material. Your eye likes it, your eye and brain likes that better, actually, than adding more resolution, because it has an easier time seeing. And, you know, like if you watch a football game, it's dark on one end of the field and very bright on the other. And when they try to set the iris on the cameras, it's not good for either end. So having high dynamic range is a way of really improving the quality of the signal that wouldn't necessarily be improved by increasing resolution. I don't know. Does that answer your question?
Yes, it did. Thumbs up on that one, too. One last question, and then we're out of time.
Yeah, sure. My question concerns the ability to get the signal from the studio out to the transmitter site. And in my situation, I have 5 different microwave hops involved. So is there a secure error correction that can be done to accomplish going from IF to IF to IF down to fiber and then back up to IF to get it out to the transmitter itself? And then how does that affect the reception capability out there for the viewer then?
Yeah, first, there's a standard in AT&T 3, one of the AT&T 3 standards, the 22 that I mentioned, is for a thing called STLTP, or Studio to Transmitter Link Transport Protocol. I won't go into all of the things that are in the protocol. It's an IP-based protocol. It's a standard UDP protocol. But inside of it, there is levels of security. It's actually sitting inside of a tunnel, if you're familiar with IP tunnel is. And that tunnel is one layer of security, but within that tunnel, you have the ability to set not only the level of forward error correction, which is great, which we haven't had in the past, but in addition, we also have the ability to set the amount of cryptography, how much scrambling or how much security you want on that service. And the reason they do that is because not everybody uses their own private facilities to get their signal up to their transmitter site. Sometimes you have to make use of public facilities. And you don't really want your services to be going out on a public facility where it can be, you know, lifted or messed with or man in the middle of the attack or any of those kind of things. So the point is that is optional. You don't have to use that level of security, but it's a way in which you can secure, and it's built into the equipment for you to set the level of security. Also, a single broadcast gateway, which is that last box I showed you in my little diagram, that can feed a number of transmitters at one time. In the case of a SFN, for example, inside of AT&T 3, you can address each one of the transmitters individually, but it's essentially the same stream other than the addressing. And so you want to have that kind of level of security, since it's probably going to go out to maybe 2, 3, 4, 5, depending on how dense the SFN is. how many nodes you have. So yeah, it's all built in. Short explanation. it's built into this the system to begin with, so you don't have to worry.
Very good, Dave, and we'll have to leave it there for today. Thank you very much for being here with us. Round of applause, please, for Dave Folsom.